WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is Veterans Day, and it's the 75th anniversary of the end of World War I, the war that was to end all wars. My guest, Tim Pat Coogan, is from Northern Ireland, where the conflict never ends. For 20 years, Coogan was the editor of the Irish Press, a newspaper published in Dublin. He's the author of several books about the conflict in Northern Ireland, including The IRA, A History, which he's just revised and updated. The first edition was published in Great Britain in 1970. Coogan is visiting the States, and I asked him on this World War I anniversary to reflect on the duration of the troubles in Northern Ireland, which has already left over 3,000 people dead and 30,000 injured.
Oh, indeed. Veterans Day is a very appropriate time to reflect on this appalling tragedy. Though I have to say I didn't require Veterans Day to make me reflect on it, because it's been part of my the warp and woof of my daily life for a quarter of a century. And before my birth, before these centuries, the Irish quarrel in fact predated the coming of Columbus to this country. I think we have to reflect more on than merely on Northern Ireland when we're talking about Veterans Day, because all conflicts come to an end sometime. There's always a peace process. The peace table is brought out and the guns are put away. The tragedy of Northern Ireland is that the peace process is less evident than the violence.
We're in a period now where, on the one hand, there have been talks trying to move things closer to reconciliation. On the other hand, there's been an upswing in violence in Northern Ireland. Let's start with the talks. There's been two sets of talks going on. What are those talks about?
The two sets of talks are, firstly, those between the leaders of both the constitutional nationalists in Northern Ireland, led by John Hume, and the Sinn Féin party, which represents the IRA and is led by Gerry Adams. And what they were talking about in a nutshell was finding a way to get Sinn Féin to the conference table and getting a formula which would give some prospect of achieving Sinn Féin's goal, which is getting the British out of Ireland at some stage.
The British don't want Sinn Féin at
the British conference table. The British don't want Sinn Féin at the conference table. They've said no to anything that would involve what they call, in shorthand, the Hume-Adams process. And they want to talk instead to the Irish government. Now, the Irish government have tried to meet this difficulty by involving, as it were, the principles contained in the Hume-Adams formula, in their six principles, as they're known as. And the hope in Ireland and in England at the moment is that the two sovereign governments, London and Dublin, would be able to talk, and from that bring to the conference table all the contending parties in Northern Ireland, with the exception of Sinn Féin, but including Sinn Féin, if the IRA would lay down their arms. The problem about that is that the IRA, who are the motor force in the whole situation, are not prepared to stop the armed struggle until they can see a prospect of what they were struggling for being achieved. And they're not going to come out of their holes, as it were, and be seen in the light of day, have their guns taken off them, maybe be arrested, as has happened before when they had ceasefires. They want to be much nearer to the table and much more certain that they're going to get what they want before they'll stop.
Is there any connection between the talks that have been going on and the upswing in violence in Northern Ireland?
Every connection. The Loyalists have become inflamed by the prospect of Sinn Féin getting what it wants, getting to the conference table, and they have stepped up their attacks on the Catholics. Far more Catholics have been killed now by the Loyalists than the IRA are killing on the security force side. The whole of the Unionist establishment, the North of Ireland Loyalist establishment, have been making very dire and threatening noises for some time. I have heard Loyalist politicians talking about almost the necessity for Dublin being bombed before Dublin will see sense and do what is right. And what is right in the Loyalist eyes is that we should introduce internment without trial, lock up the IRA, and they would do the same up there and in Northern Ireland and throw away the gloves and throw away the key. But of course that solution, a purely military one, which has been tried before and failed, does nothing to address the political situation. And if they even got a temporary cessation of violence, which I doubt, what is certain is that the violence would recommence.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Pat Coogan. He's the author of the new book, The IRA, A History. Your new book about the IRA has actually been expanded several times. You wrote your first history of the IRA back in 1969. That was a time of the IRA's resurgence and the beginning of a new period in the conflict. What were you expecting then? You were writing a book on the history of the IRA then. What were you expecting was going to become of the IRA?
When I began it, the IRA was a defunct volcano. You were talking about people who had taken part in the Black and Tan War and sputtered into existence and out of existence between then and 1969. That's between 1921 and 1969, with occasional attacks and bombings, but were gone into the mists of history. But history caught up with Ireland because of the American Civil Rights Movement. A new breed of educated young Catholics in Northern Ireland took to the streets looking for an end to discrimination against Catholics, an end to the system, the apartheid-like system that they lived under. And the security forces, the Loyalist security forces, just battened them off the streets. And a lot of younger, hot-headed men just recreated the tradition of the IRA and said, well, we've had enough of this peaceful method, we'll use the gun. They were accelerated in doing that by a number of onslaughts on Catholic areas. The British troops were sent in August of 69 to keep the peace between the two factions, but they rapidly became drawn in on one side and one side only, on the Unionist side. There were a number of right-angle turning points when the thing went down. One was the what was known as the Rape of the Falls Road, when they cordoned off the Falls Road, which is the Catholic area, looking for guns. And even though there was 100,000 licensed weapons on the Protestant side, there were no searches in Protestant areas. That stepped up recruitment to the IRA. The next bad mistake was the introduction of internment, in which only Catholics were locked up. And that was accompanied by such awful behaviour that the government in Dublin had to take the British government to the Court of Human Rights, alleging torture against them. And then the third big incident was the famous Bloody Sunday shootings, when the British paratroopers fired on a march that was demonstrating against internment. And those kind of incidents gave a kind of a moral blanket to the IRA, which even subsequent atrocities that they committed didn't take away. And they kept going since.
In your new book, you write about somebody who you call Sean. You're obviously not giving real names here. And you've known his family for over 20 years, or at least 20 years. You knew his parents before he was even born. And you thought that because of his temperament, he would never join the IRA, even though he comes from a Republican family. But a few years ago, he did join the IRA. Tell us why he joined and how you found out about it.
Well, I found out about it because he came to see me when I was actually writing a book. And he told me that he had news for me. And I thought he meant to say he was getting engaged, and I congratulated him. But no. Apparently, a member of the security forces had killed a teenager with a rubber bullet. Instead of firing at the ground or getting them in the legs, he'd fired straight into the child's face and killed them dead. And the boy, Sean, just snapped at that point and said, I'm going to have to do something about this. There's no use doing it by legal means or waiting for constitutional methods or thinking of civil rights or anything. There's only one thing for it. It's the gun. And he came down to Dublin to see me and to tell me this. And I was on my own in my bunker, my study, and I was able to talk to him very frankly. We talked for a long time, but I simply couldn't talk him out of it. Everything I said to him, it was like point counterpoint. He was prepared to take the risk of being shot. He was prepared to take the guilt of killing someone, because that's what happens in a war. And his refrain all the time was, sure, what else can you do? So he was a very tall, good-looking boy, blonde hair. And I pointed out to him, which was true, that because he was a Catholic, coming from a strongly Republican area, that he'd be on every special branch videotape that was ever taken at a Republican funeral or a Republican demonstration, and that even though he wasn't in anything himself, his friends were, he was born in that area, and they'd have a complete dossier on him. He still said the IRA would get round that somewhere and he'd have to do this. It was a matter of honour. So he went away. I was very depressed, and he was sort of confident about it. And he came to see me again about a year later, and he had changed. He wasn't as blonde-haired as he'd been. He'd a different haircut, and the hair was a bit darkened. But he was quite obviously now a soldier off duty. He was fit-looking, and he was wearing... It was obviously psychologically he had chosen sort of fatigue, drill clothing to wear, even though he was down in Dublin and away from the troubles. And he said, I done that, Tim Pot. And I said, you don't have to tell me. I can tell by looking at you, you know, that you're in it. So we had another chat, and he could see I was depressed again. And he told me to cheer up and shook hands with me as he was pulling out of the drive of my house. And he said he was trying to find some way of sort of bridging the gap before he went off, before we parted, in a nice way. And he said, look, we'll have a pint. We'll have a pint. And then the way he came out with it, it shows you how the unconscious brutalization of the whole situation works. He said, we'll have a pint in the corporal's rest. That sounds an innocent term, but that's the name of the club. That's the colloquial name given to the club where two British corporals were lynched when they drove into a funeral by accident a couple of years ago. It was an appalling thing. And the people locally refer to that as the corporal's rest, sort of gallows humour. So I was just thinking it was a piece of apt symbolism. This very fine young fellow was now well on the road to being brutalised. So off he went, and of course he was picked up.
So you knew he was in the IRA. What did and he got arrested eventually. What did he get picked up for? How did he get picked up?
He was picked up with a group of other young men on explosive charges. And he was, after a long period in remand, he was brought to trial. And in fact, I understand that the sentence is due to be handed down this very week. And he's in his early 20s, as I say, and he's looking at anything from, it could be anything from 10 to 24 years, I've been told, is a likely sentence. Anyway, it's terrible destruction of a young man's life. In one way, it's probably a good thing to have him out of the way. He's not going to get killed. And he may also study in jail. But it's just symptomatic of the human wreckage that this thing is causing. A nicer lad you wouldn't meet beforehand. He's still a lovely boy, but I visited him a while ago in jail. And he's now become a leader. You can tell by him he's tougher, and he's the leader of his wing of the IRA in the jail. And he's it takes so many warders to carry him out if he doesn't want to come out. And he's been on punishment routines, you know, locked in the cell all day for a month with all privileges withdrawn and bedding taken away. And he's prepared to take that and to do it, you know.
Do you sense if he has any regrets about joining the IRA?
Not at the moment. The morale is very high in the prisons, amongst the prisoners, and they have become, as I said, they're the most powerful guerrilla force in Western Europe. They've learned lessons from this kind of thing from all over the world, from the actual struggle itself. And in prison, one of the things they do is they have their own command structure, their own camaraderie, and they use sort of psychological methods to keep people from being depressed. For example, he said to me, no, you couldn't get depressed in here. It's the most awful-looking prison you ever saw. I mean, I was depressed even going into it. He said, no, you couldn't get depressed in here because if you do, they put two men on you. That's the IRA. It's two pals, and they keep chatting to you and talking to you and telling you jokes. They are minders, and they make you snap out of it. That's what he said anyway. So that's just one indication. The IRA have a saying that if you break the lads in prison, you break the IRA. So they're very careful. That's why they fought that prison strike so hard with Bobby Sands' death. They weren't. If the prison population cracked, the relations outside would crack and the civilian support would crack for the IRA. So he's clearly, unless the struggle ends, he's clearly destined for the life and possibly the death of a guerrilla.
My guest is Tim Pat Coogan, author of The IRA, A History. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Irish journalist Tim Pat Coogan. How much do you think that the idea of guns and adventure has to do with young people joining the IRA?
Well, there must be a percentage of that, young men being what they are, young women, but it's not the whole story. And I doubt that that motivation would survive the IRA training process, which is pretty brutal. I quote there in my book from the Green Book, which indicates the kind of process that they go through. It's the IRA's training manual, as it were, their Bible. And it's pretty awful. I mean, it's...
What kind of stuff?
Well, they're trained in counter-interrogation techniques. They're trained how to withstand torture. They're trained... Obviously, they're trained how to kill. They're trained in intelligence. They're trained to regard their foes as the enemy, and you kill enemies. And there's a whole lot of techniques they practice. And having gone through that, I think, sort of facile adventure, it's one of the things they warn them flatly. If you're coming in here for an easy life or kind of Wild West activities or romance, forget it. You can not alone lose your life, you can lose your marriage, your family, you know, torture, imprisonment. These things are not pleasant. Death is not pleasant either to contemplate for yourself or to inflict on others. So they know all that going into it.
You've interviewed many people in the IRA. You've been writing about the IRA for over 20 years. Have you ever been caught in the middle of a terrorist act, or do you have any friends or family who were injured by those acts?
Oh, I would say, no, I haven't personally been involved in anything, touch wood, so far. But between, I mean, I haven't only interviewed the IRA. I mean, I've made a point of trying to understand the loyalist mind, and I have friends on that side too.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they were very valuable ones. I was able to go between the IRA and the UDA, and I got the IRA to call off their car bombing at one period. That was maddening the loyalists, and it was making for sectarian killings. So the leader of the UDA agreed that if the IRA would stop, I put it to him that if the IRA would stop the car bombing, would he stop the sectarian killings, random killings of innocent Catholics? He said he would. So the IRA agreed immediately. There's a man called Dahi O'Connell, like I mentioned his name because he's dead. But Dahi agreed to stop the car bombing, and he had invented the car bomb technique, actually.
Mm.
And the sectarian killing stopped. That for a short while. That was some years ago. It'd be quite irrelevant now.
This is some role for a journalist to take on, an intermediary trying to stop acts of violence. How did you feel about that?
Well, I'm a human being, first of all, and an author or a journalist, secondly. I'm Irish, and as far as I'd be concerned, they're both Irish. There's no particular role. I just knew from the talk of one of them what was driving him mad, which was the car bombing, and I just asked him, I mean, are you saying that that stopped, that you'd be able to stop, you would stop, you'd be prepared to stop the killing so that you could? And he said, of course we would. Well, I felt that was something that I just couldn't not act on. So I did, and with very beneficial results. And it's one of the reasons I'd be very hopeful. I mean, I think that they should try talking to the IRA now, because if what one man can do in a small scale, maybe a government can do in a grand scale.
Well, one last question. You obviously want your journalism to have some kind of impact in the movement toward peace, toward the end of the Troubles. You've told us about several things that seem to have quite an impact, several things that you've done. Is there any other one thing that you'd like to mention to us, either a story that you wrote or an action that you took that you felt had some kind of positive impact?
Well, there would be a number of things, but the time is not right to write about them. The thing is going on. I suppose, in a nutshell, what I'm trying to do and what I have done is to act in the belief that the illumination of problems helps in their solution, and censorship sweeping it under the carpet and saying, no, this is our row. This is a private fight. You can't get in on it. That's rubbish. That has led to all these deaths, the death squads, and the horrors we've seen, particularly in the last few weeks. I mean, Belfast is a real city of fear today as we talk. And if they can do it in the Middle East, and they can do it in Russia, and they can do it in South Africa, it's about time that Ireland and England, who are both mother countries after all, it's about time that the mother countries appeal to the kids to come in and help. There are always times in a family when you need your relations. And certainly there's never been a better time for that to happen than now in Ireland.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tim Pett Coogan is the author of The IRA, A History.